Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The politics of the Middle East are tricky enough. Today, the president took on the economics of it as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, today the 19th of May. Good to have you with us. There was an economic nugget wrapped inside the president's speech on the Middle East today, in between announcing $2 billion for Egypt and a promise to help the region overall grow economically. He said you just can't base a lasting development strategy on stuff that comes out of the ground.
If you take out oil exports, this entire region of over 400 million people exports roughly the same amount as Switzerland.
So to explore what the president's speech might actually mean in Egypt and the region, we've called Magda Candle. She's the director of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies over in Cairo. Dr. Candle, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This speech was in some measure about economics as a way to get to the politics of it, as a way to get the Middle East toward democracy. Is what the president outlined today enough to do that, or at least get things started?
It's quite enough to get things started. The situation has become difficult for the government of Egypt, not having resources to cope with the many other priorities that the government should embark on at this point. And I don't think the United States government would do a lot of favor or help this economy by extending assistance in the form of current spending by the government of Egypt. I think priorities should be homegrown from a strategic point of view. And I think what the president outlined is correct, that as an economic partner, I want to help you stabilize your situation. But I think the best form to help the social agenda of this country is to help create jobs.
The president said today he wants this not to be a package of assistance, but he wants it to be trade and a partnership. What's that going to look like? How is he going to help the Egyptian economy grow that way?
Actually, this is the best component of what has come out today from Washington, because we're not talking about short-term assistance in the form of debt forgiveness. It's timely. It's needed. No one would argue around this. But also, what you need is having a long-lasting partnership. And this is what happens when American investors would bring their money to this economy, capitalizing on the potential for growth and knowing that they're capitalizing on the strategic location that serves as a gateway to Africa, to the Middle East, and across to Europe.
Would you characterize this as a big change in America's economic approach to Egypt and the Middle East?
I think so. I think this is a golden opportunity for the United States to boost its image. And for the longest time, the United States policy has been focused on the political dimension. And the United States has been very generous in extending financial assistance. But oftentimes, the average person on the street did not feel the benefits of this assistance in a very tangible way that would touch upon their personal lives. But this will directly go to the average person on the street. They would feel that as the economy is growing, there is a partner that cared about them and their future as well.
One last thing. This was obviously the big news story of the day over here, right at the very top of the headlines. Mm-hmm. What was it like over in Cairo? Were there a lot of people watching this speech, do you think?
The timing of it was evening time, yeah. Cairo time, and this is also the beginning of the weekend. I'm not sure that it has gained as much attention as the first speech when he was here in Cairo and delivered his speech. It's no secret that people have become cynical again, that the promises have been broken, 2 years have passed, nothing has moved. But I wouldn't worry much about this. I think the action plan that follows the speech, I think, is more important, that could help work out a lot of differences.
Magda Candel is the executive director of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies. We reached her, obviously, in Cairo today. Dr. Candel, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
On Wall Street this Thursday, forget economic data and the speech and repeat after me. Three little letters is all it's going to take. I, P, and O. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The president mentioned a couple of times today that the Middle East is, in essence, ignoring one of its most important economic assets. Commentator Isabel Coleman says nothing is going to change in the region until that changes.
Millions of unemployed youth facing grim economic prospects have fueled the revolutions. Not surprisingly, women have played a prominent role, too. Across the region, they experience higher levels of unemployment than men, yet have rising economic expectations. Just as in the West, women in the Middle East are overtaking men in college graduation rates. They are 65% of college graduates in the UAE and Iran. Even in deeply conservative Saudi Arabia, women make up more than half of college graduates. They are not only increasingly educated, but ambitious, too. The problem is that women in the Middle East still face considerable social and legal obstacles to working. That's a fact reflected in their low workforce participation rates. Just listen to these numbers. Tunisia has one of the highest rates in the Middle East, with less than a third of women working. In Saudi Arabia, where gender segregation is imposed and women cannot drive, it's only 5%. The region faces a double economic whammy, now of wasting the productive capacity of women. The private sector has been unwelcoming because their also entrenched conservative values and religious biases persist. So female talent in the Middle East tends to gravitate to the public sector, finding employment as teachers, bureaucrats, and healthcare workers. Women are also starting their own businesses, and that's helping to drive entrepreneurship across the region. I attended the 4th Annual Global Competitiveness Forum in Riyadh last year, and about a quarter of the 20 or so entrepreneurs who won prizes, in categories from fast growth to responsible competitiveness, were women. This is good news for the Middle East. The countries of the Middle East need to figure out how to open the private sector to women. Economic aid flowing into the region should include investments supporting education and opportunities for women. Making full use of female talent will be the only way to achieve growth and stability in the years ahead.
Isabel Coleman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's also the author of the book Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. Write to us. Online is best. Marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Dominique Strauss-Kahn made bail today. The head of the IMF will be under house arrest in Manhattan while the case against him proceeds. The news of the weekend means even those unfamiliar with international finance now know that IMF stands for the International Monetary Fund. Here's another one, less familiar, taken straight from the pages of the recent financial reform law, OFR, the Office of Financial Research. It's a brand new government outfit that we are told is vital to our future financial health. Our series, Economy 4.0, is all about that, how to make the global economy work better for more people. So our special correspondent, David Brancaccio, has been out playing with metaphors to try to explain what this OFR thing is supposed to do anyway.
When the financial storm was howling in full force about 2 years ago, Penn State professor John Lichty popped over to a workshop on financial risk and statistics, the sort of thing he likes to do.
I'm a statistician. I heard about it. I thought I'll go and see what they're talking about.
What seemed freaky to Lichty was the focus on keeping individual banks safe from disaster.
So I raised my hand in this meeting and I said, who's got the data on the entire financial system? And the answer was that nobody really has the data.
There was a terrifying thought. No one keeps track of the whole kit and caboodle.
Then I thought, this is dangerous. This is crazy.
That realization sparked a cool idea. But before we get to it, let's travel back in time to September 8th, 1900. Without getting too Ken Burnsy, Galveston, Texas was the country's third busiest port, a boomtown with electric streetcars, concert halls, and French chefs. That is, until calamity struck.
What time was it when it happened?
A Category 4 hurricane with winds topping 150 miles an hour smashed into Galveston.
Was it during the night?
About 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
In the daytime when that wind and that weather came up.
This was recorded by the grandchildren of Caroline Shopper Harris in 1981. She survived standing on a pile of mattresses in the family's attic. 8,000 people died, mostly drownings. There had been no warning at all.
They didn't have things out to, you know, to let people know.
It was just, I'm sure, one of the most horrifying, gruesome moments in continental American history.
According to Eric Larson, who wrote a book about the storm, the forecast for the day was fair, fresh, possibly brisk.
Even though everybody in that era thought that weather forecasting was a pretty complete science, it certainly was not.
Thankfully, 1900 was not the pinnacle year of our meteorological understanding. But what happened in Galveston ultimately led to, metaphor alert, the formation of the National Hurricane Center, an agency dedicated to understanding and predicting hurricanes. What does this have to do with the new Office of Financial Research? Back to Professor Lichty, statistician.
If you think about the way science works, first of all, it seeks to understand a phenomenon. Then it tries to explain how it works. And ultimately, it tries to get to the point where it can predict it. You know, so with the weather, where are we at? We understand the weather. We are able to explain it. And we are able to some degree, predict it. With the financial markets, I believe we're probably at the point where we're just beginning to understand it.
Lichty wants the government to treat the markets as a science. So the Office of Financial Research will collect data from the country's financial institutions regularly, automatically.
Here is the hazardous weather outlook for South Florida for today and tonight.
Instead of tracking temperatures and air pressure, the new office plans to collect daily transaction logs from the country's financial institutions. It could look at who's holding what types of risk, and it'll use computer modeling to try to forecast, say, sunny skies over the bond market or a Category 5 storm bearing down on the mortgage market.
And now the extended outlook for the period.
The idea is for this financial storm tracking center to warn policymakers at the Treasury, the Fed, or in Congress as red flags pop up. Professor Lichty thinks had the office been in place, it could have caught what he sees as low-hanging fruit like Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. And maybe even called attention to accidents waiting to happen like credit default swaps, but with one big caveat from the professor.
One of the interesting things about the analogy where it breaks down between the financial markets and hurricanes is that hurricanes don't respond to hurricane forecasts.
Meaning you can't spook a hurricane and make it worse, but you can spook a market. Government officials will have to be very careful their new early warning data doesn't end up causing the very instability it's meant to predict and avoid. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Coming up, those about to butcher, we salute you.
I mean, they say, I'm a rock star, you know? It's like, what does that mean, I'm a rock star? We just got some pigs.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street pondered a mix of news today and in the end decided to focus on the positive. The Dow Industrials rode the seesaw before coming to rest 45 points higher, a third of 1%, 12,605 the number. The NASDAQ added 8 points, not quite a third of 1%, 28.23. The S&P 500 tacked on 2 points, nearly a quarter percent, closed at 13.43. The market story of the day going away was LinkedIn. We told you yesterday it was about to become the first big social networking site to take its shares public. Well, you see what I mentioned on this program? Can do the stock stampeded from $45 a share out of the gate to as high as $122, finished at $94, making it this year's most successful initial public offering thus far. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.17%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. The American Petroleum Institute releases monthly statistics on the demand for oil and gasoline for April. Save those plants and animals. National Endangered Species Day, started by the U.S. Senate, is observed. And if we could turn back time, on this day in 1946, American superstar Cher was born. I'm Christina Sarnelli.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in the day, Ford was all about hot rods. Now it's all about souping up its cars with electronic gadgets, stuff like voice-operated entertainment systems, like a lot of companies have. Last week, Ford teamed up with Google in a project to analyze your driving habits and help you speed up your commute. The technological tie-in today is a little more serious, maybe even life or death, as Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz reports.
If you bought a new Ford in the past few years, you might have a voice command system on board. You can check traffic, call up your favorite song. You probably have not had it ask you this.
Have you had your breakfast yet?
That's from a Ford demo video, and it's asking because the guy behind the wheel has low blood sugar. But Ford's vision for diabetic drivers goes further than reminding you to eat your Frosted Flakes. Through a partnership with Medtronic, the medical device maker, drivers could essentially plug their bodies into the car. Here's Medtronic's Brian Henry.
So you'd have a sensor, which would be sort of in your midsection, maybe a quarter-sized monitor or a sensor that's on there.
This glucose monitor sends info to the car using Bluetooth. It's a matter of convenience and safety. Haiti Merritt admits manually checking her glucose while driving, sort of like texting, and she knows others who don't. That's way worse.
I have a friend who chooses to drive at levels that are unsafe. And then I have another friend who actually crashed into a toll booth because his blood sugar was so low that he kind of blacked out.
Some diabetic drivers have concerns. Could the system prevent them from driving, even to the hospital? Could onboard glucose data be used in accident lawsuits? The makers have some time to address these. For now, the product is still in the pipeline. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
After a dismal couple of years for college fundraising, this year is shaping up to be a pretty good one. A number of big gifts have made the headlines. Billionaire investor George Soros pledged $60 million for Bard College this week. The University of Pennsylvania got a couple of hundred million for its medical school last month. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
You've heard of pent-up consumer demand, how people rush out to buy stuff when the economy improves. Something like that may be going on in philanthropy. Ray Goldsmith is with the Council for Advancement and Support of Education. She says donors would have made most of these really large gifts anyway, but held back until the market improved.
The fact that we're seeing so many of those major gifts now is a good signal that donors have much more confidence in their own financial stability, which means they've got much more confidence in the stability of the economy.
Overall, Goldsmith's group expects college donations to increase more than 5.5% this year. That's compared to just 0.5% increase last year and a 12% decline the year before that. Michael Nilsson is with the Association of Fundraising Professionals. He's seeing a thaw in all kinds of charitable giving.
But 2008 and 2009 were so awful, frankly, for charitable fundraising. You know, even with these increases, there's still a ways to go to get back to where we were.
Still, if universities raise more money this year, maybe they won't have to raise tuition quite as much. Ray Goldsmith says with endowments still recovering and public funding evaporating, don't count on it. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's some power grid news today. Interestingly, it comes to us courtesy of Google. The search company owns part of a project to build a new underwater transmission line that will eventually carry wind-generated power up and down the East Coast. Today, federal regulators approved the rate of return that Google and its partners will be allowed to earn on their $5 billion investment. 12.5% is the number, not too shabby. But over in the Pacific Northwest, there's already too much of a good thing when it comes to renewable power. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains the dilemma.
This year, the Pacific Northwest is experiencing an embarrassment of riches, Mother Nature's.
We're blessed with a whole lot of wind and water here in the Northwest that can create energy.
Doug Johnson is with the Bonneville Power Administration. He says spring flows into the Columbia River Basin are the biggest in 14 years. So hydroelectric dams are generating lots of electricity. So much, in fact, that the agency managing most of the Pacific Northwest's electricity just made a controversial decision. Rachel Shimshak is a renewable energy advocate.
The Bonneville Power Administration has made a determination that when there's too much energy, they're going to unilaterally cut off wind generators in order to manage the system.
That's exactly what Bonneville's done on and off for the last 2 days. Robert Kahn heads up a coalition of independent power producers. He says wind producers now stand to lose tens of millions of dollars.
If their blades aren't spinning and they're not generating wind power, then they will not be entitled to the production tax credit, which is a source of revenue for the wind farms.
Bonneville insists it can't cut back on hydropower. It contends that spilling the excess water over dams creates gases harmful to fish. But the agency's dilemma signals a larger national problem. Development of wind is outpacing grid capacity. Daniel Brooks at the Electric Power Research Institute says there's a lot of resistance to new power lines.
Folks don't want a transmission line running through their backyard generally. There's also environmental issues.
The Bonneville Power Administration says it's working on expanding transmission. First, though, it may have some legal work to attend to. Wind producers are expected to sue the agency over the new policy as early as next week. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
I don't know the last time you were in an actual butcher shop as opposed to the meat section of your local grocery store, but butchering is back as foodies embrace the full use of the animal in question, from nose all the way down to tail. Boutique butcheries are popping up that feature animals raised naturally and cuts of meat that extend well beyond chops and loins. Restaurants are in on the whole animal trend, too, so maybe head cheese is going to replace cupcakes as the it food, or maybe not. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill has the story.
His pig is called Fat, and the other one's Fatter.
Lefty Ayers raises pigs outside of Los Angeles at Reride Ranch. He gives two of his Berkshire pigs, named Fat and Fatter, a little love.
So we pet them, and they're like a couple big cats almost.
Ayers feeds his pigs natural foods. He avoids antibiotics. He fills their troughs with vegetables and dairy a nearby grocery store can't sell. Think outdated gallons of milk and wilted lettuce. The pigs have been good for business. Once chefs, butchers, and food bloggers found out about his animals, which are high-end breeds, finished with acorns and prized by Epicureans.
It was kind of goofy the way people were acting towards us. I mean, we didn't know how to react. I mean, they say, I'm a rock star, you know? It's like, what does that mean, I'm a rock star? We just got some pigs.
In a matter of days, Fat the pig will be slaughtered and wind up on the butcher table at McCall's Meat and Fish in Los Feliz, a hip neighborhood in Los Angeles. Store owner Nathan McCall did a little tweeting last time they had one of Ayers' pigs, and...
We had a line down the block, and we sold out in the matter of hours.
McCall's is one of a growing number of gourmet butchers opening around the country. The chop from Fat the Pig will cost $18 a pound, about three times as much as grocery store pork. McCall says his customers want, first and foremost, good food. But some come in thinking about sustainability. It's hard to ever call meat really good for the environment. It takes far more resources to grow animals than plants. And there's a sense among dedicated meat eaters, if you're gonna eat meat, the most ethical way to do it is to eat all of the animal. Chef Chad Colby teaches a pig butchery demonstration class at the LA restaurant Moza.
I just referred to it recently as pig Tetris.
Tetris, like the computer game, where you have to fit all the pieces together. Pig Tetris is coming up with ways to cook and sell all the parts of the pig. Some bits are easy, loin, belly, and then some are tougher, like the spine, feet, and tail.
I cook it all off with the head and make really what we called recently a nose-to-tail salami. and that becomes the pig Tetris finale.
Entire pig eaten, at least the parts that are edible. Colby says he's able to cook and sell parts of the pig that factory farms turn into pet food. Of course, eating all the parts of an animal isn't new. It's common in lots of the world. But it's novel to diners in the U.S. who are starting to think more about where their food comes from, who want to know that their bacon started out as Fat the Pig, raised by Lefty Ayers, the farmer. Andrew Freeman is a restaurant consultant.
Chefs find it adventurous and fun, but it's really good for the environment and for, you know, ecologically to use the whole animal.
Whole animal eating is also sustainable in another way. It can be cheaper for restaurants and butchers than bringing in just parts, helping keep them in business. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
For those of you into pigs and pork, we've got some pictures of Lefty's pigs and a time lapse of Chef Colby's butchery class on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which the CEO of McDonald's gets a little bit carried away with himself. There was news the other day that a group of healthcare professionals want the burger chain to 86 Ronald McDonald to get rid of him as a way to stop marketing directly to children. Today at the company's annual meeting, CEO Jim Skinner objected. This is about choice, and we believe in democratic process, he said. This is about the personal and individual right to choose. Or it's about kids and hamburgers. And that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow climbed 45 points, a third of 1%. You can thank LinkedIn for that. The NASDAQ added 8 points, not quite a third of 1%. The S&P 500, why it tacked on 2 points, quarter of 1%. Thanks for asking. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here.
What more could we ask for? It's going to be one of the most historic days we're ever going to witness, and that's why there's such excitement built up around us.
Obama mania in Ireland, ahead of the president's trip there next week. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.